Hello and welcome to another edition of Over the Shoulder. I'm Glenn Lynch. It is the interesting, provocative, and investigative show that you see on cable access. And make sure you check your local cable access or community channel for times and dates. It was June 5th, 1968, 12:15 a.m. at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, California, in the pantry. Robert Kennedy was shot. And today we're going to examine the possibility of reopening that case. My guest sitting across from me, Lawrence Teeter, is the attorney for Sirhan Sirhan. On the telephone, a Robert Kennedy researcher, Lynn Mangan. And off screen, for security reasons, we have the brother of Sirhan Sirhan, Adel Sirhan. And Adel, can you hear me okay?
I can, sir.
Okay, I want to ask you a couple of questions first about your brother.
Yes, ma'am.
Before the killing of Robert Kennedy, did he have anything against Kennedy? Had he ever said anything to you that he didn't like Kennedy, that he had anything against him at all?
Not at all. Not whatsoever.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Okay, what was your brother like? Because there's little known about Sirhan, and I think that's probably the fault of the media and maybe the fault of the government agencies who I think have held back a lot of information. But what was he like back in the 60s?
He was extremely intelligent, very courteous, and very cordial. He had his own way of doing things. But for instance, if he didn't work, he would be at the library enlightening himself. His interest was broad, many interests in reading, in doing his horse work, for instance, like when he was working at the ranch as a hired hand there. He was very courteous, bright, and very family-oriented, and a very nice fellow all the way around.
Okay, let me ask you again, and I want this to be very clear to the viewers. Did he have any kind of dislike or grudge or anything against Robert Kennedy?
Not whatsoever.
None whatsoever. Okay, sitting across from me is the attorney for Sirhan, Larry Teeter. Larry, how did you get involved in this?
Well, it's a long story. By accident, I met a researcher on this case named Greg Stone, who had been an aide to Congressman Albert Lowenstein. Lowenstein had attempted to get the House Committee, the House Select Subcommittee on Assassinations, to investigate this case. This is the only case that Congress never looked into. One thing led to another, and I wound up working with Greg and a number of other people in Los Angeles in an attempt to pressure the Los Angeles Police Department under Daryl Gates into finally releasing the police department's files on this case. And the result of that is that in 1988, 20 years after the assassination, the police were forced through political action to finally disgorge their files, which were then transported to the state archives. And researchers discovered that massive amounts of material was missing at that point, including thousands of photographs that had been discovered were incinerated by the police department on orders from senior officials within 3 months of the assassination.
So we had photos that were burned.
Yes, yeah. In the wake of that, further efforts were made to develop additional information. Researchers requested that the FBI disgorge the names of the agents who had participated in the investigation. Obviously, researchers like to interview agents and employees of police agencies to find out what they say in comparison with what's in their reports. And the FBI stubbornly resisted this. We brought a court action in Washington, D.C., and ultimately I was asked to take over this case.
Okay, you mentioned the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Why didn't they investigate the Robert Kennedy assassination?
Well, that's a very good question. I think, in fact, this is the one case in which a conspiracy is clearly established by a court record, as well as a massive amount of police materials that were collected in one place. There was a trial in this case. In the James Earl Ray case, there was a coerced confession. In the Oswald case, there was an assassination that took place in the police station that silenced the suspect and conveniently obviated the need for a trial. But in this case, there was a trial. There was a great record, therefore. If the House Committee on Assassinations did not want to look into assassinations and find evidence of government cover-up, this is the one case they would ignore, and they ignored it.
Researcher Lynn Mangan, evidence suppressed? What about it?
Well, yes, of course.
Tell us a little about the torn gun label. You and I talked about that last night, and I think it was very interesting.
Yes, that's shocking. Adele is there in your studio, and
yes, if I may, if
that
I may.
The entire Sirhan family was removed from their home on the day of the assassination, June 5, kept out of their home. Not one family member was in their home for over a week. And that the investigation of the premises, the inside of the house, the outside of the house, the garage, was conducted by the FBI, the LAPD, the Pasadena Police Department came in the next day. And a Pasadena police officer discovered a torn gun label lying on a box of trash right by the garage. And so he made his report out. And it was delivered to the Los Angeles Police Department the following day. So let's fast forward now to the trial. This officer's name was Thomas Young. He testified, and it was a very short testimony, but right after he testified, a very curious thing happened. The attorney of record, Grant Cooper, spoke off the record and then made a statement that Sirhan had agreed to keep this evidence out, the torn gun label. He didn't say it was a torn gun label. This was never mentioned, but just the balance of the content that was in Officer Young's packet. So what went into evidence was the Argonaut insurance envelope, RFK must die. That became People's Exhibit 75. But 75A was for identification only, and was never disclosed. The content of that was never disclosed, and that was the torn gun label, along with Officer Young's report and a little shopping list that Sirhan had written in Arabic. But the important thing is that the little portion of the torn gun label, a very small portion, has been removed. But it bears the gun number H53725. Now, that would only help the prosecution's case to put that in evidence. Why would they keep that out? Well, I understand why, because of the balance of the information on that, the information that it's the cadet model 55SA. But you see, if you follow back to this particular gun, the problem with it is that when the grand jury took possession of this gun, curiously, no gun number was ever given. No gun number is reported in that entire grand jury transcript. So now you get to the trial 6 months later, and here you can corroborate that that's the right gun number, and they bury it. And how come, mysteriously, that's discovered the following day after the FBI had made a thorough search?
A lot of questions unanswered. Adele Sirhan sitting off screen for safety reasons. Do you recall your family being removed on June 5th?
Yes, I do.
What happened? What was it like?
Without any explanation for reasons of their own, they decided to move us out of the house. We had no access to it, but maybe myself had one or two occasions, no more than 10 or 15 minutes to go into the house, maybe fetch some clothing and things of the like. But this case is so complex. For years, our family was troubled by Sirhan's having no memory of the shooting. When we learned of the SUS, or Special Unit Senator, files were open to the public, the family began our own research of the gun, the bullets, and the official records. What we found was that the test bullets from a different gun were used for comparison test bullets. There were substitute bullets, substitute evidence envelopes, and the photographic proof of a tampering with an official evidence envelope. There was suppression of evidence and blanket stipulation to anything the prosecutors asked for. There were no defense experts, and most of the evidence was false, and these officials must answer to these questions. We brought our newly discovered evidence through the efforts of Lynn, and thank God to Mr. Harper, who entrusted her with his files before his passing, to carry on the research and to get to the truth. We did this with our newly appointed attorney representing my brother, Mr. Larry Teeter. To these three people, I am indebted, and I appreciate their efforts in helping us get
to the truth of this matter.
Okay, Adele, now I wouldn't be a reporter worth a damn if I didn't ask you this question.
Yes.
What was your brother doing in the Ambassador Hotel that night with a gun in his hand?
He did not start out with a gun in his hand or with any motive to do anyone harm. My brother was there since he was looking for a place other than the Ambassador at one point, where somebody directed him that was a bigger and a better party going on at the Ambassador Hotel. When he was when he went there to the Ambassador, he had a few drinks, which they never mentioned about his alcohol blood, and they gave him a test, and they denied giving him a test, and this is so complex. He decides to go home when he discovered he is in no shape after having four drinks, reportedly. He could not drive home. He then saw the gun or discovered or remembered having the gun. For him to be safe, or for someone not stealing it or breaking into his car for that purpose alone, he put it in the band of his slacks, from what I understand, the reports have it. He goes back in to get some more coffee. At the coffee urn, he does not remember a thing.
So he doesn't have much in the way of a recollection as to what happened.
That's right. In fact,
many who have viewed the tape say, anyone who would look at it would say, he looked like a man in a trance. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
Yes, we now have a petition for writ of habeas corpus pending before the Supreme Court of the State of California. And one of our many exhibits is an expert witness declaration from a nationally recognized leading expert on hypnosis, a psychiatrist in New York who teaches at Columbia University, Dr. Herbert Spiegel. And Dr. Herbert Spiegel has come to the surprising but very supportable conclusion, the astonishing conclusion, but thoroughly reasoned conclusion, that Sirhan Sirhan was in a hypnotic trance at the time of the assassination, and that he was manipulated through hypnosis into walking into the pantry, pulling out a gun, and firing on a prearranged signal. And he was told under hypnosis that he would have no memory of the event. Now, you're probably wondering, gee, that's really an interesting theory, but what's the support for that? Well, there's ample support for it. When Sirhan was taken into custody, people around him observed that he seemed to be in a trance. Jesse Unruh, the Speaker of the California Assembly, commented to that effect. When Sirhan was interviewed by Dr. Bernard Diamond, a defense psychiatrist in jail, Dr. Diamond discovered immediately that Sirhan could be induced to enter a hypnotic trance very quickly, which suggested that he had been hypnotized before, that he was an experienced and outstanding hypnotic subject. Dr. Diamond also discovered that he could program Sirhan in his cell to carry out without realizing that he was acting in response to hypnotic suggestion. And I can give you one of the most dramatic examples, which it seems to me, and to our current expert on this question, Dr. Spiegel, proves Sirhan's programmability. At one point during his interview, Dr. Diamond said, all right, Sirhan, and he had placed him under hypnosis, I am going to wake you up, at which point I'm going to touch my forehead, and when I do, you're going to climb the bars of the cell like a monkey. And then he woke him up, he touched his forehead, Sirhan climbed the bars of his cell like a monkey, he hung from one arm at the top of the cell, looked down and made monkey-like faces. And when Dr. Diamond asked him, Sirhan, who told you to do that? Nobody, he said, I'm doing it on my own. So here you have an instance in which, through hypnotic programming, Sirhan could be manipulated to doing something ridiculous that he wouldn't ordinarily do without having any knowledge that he was acting in response to a prearranged signal. Sirhan's memory of this case is that he went to the coffee urn, had a conversation with an attractive woman with whom he was seen by numerous witnesses about the subject of coffee. The next thing he recognized, that he recalls, is that he's lying on the steam table of the pantry being choked. Our expert says that's all consistent with hypnotic programming having led to a state of amnesia.
You're watching Over the Shoulder, and I'm Glenn Lynch, and we're talking about the assassination of Robert Kennedy with attorney Larry Teeter, who is the attorney for Sirhan Sirhan. Sirhan's brother Adele is in studio, and on the telephone, Lynn Mangan, an RFK researcher. And Lynn, you can get in on this anytime you want. Let's talk about key evidence. The evidence shows that Kennedy was killed by contact bullet shots. Close, very close. But people in the pantry, including Carl Euchre, I believe his name is, the maitre d' at the ambassador at the time, says that no way Sirhan was between 2 and 6 feet away from Robert Kennedy. Lynn, do you want to comment on that?
Well, yes. Everybody put Sirhan at 16D on the grid, and Kennedy was at 13, and each square is a 2 foot space. And so Carl Euchre said that he stopped Sirhan. He grabbed his arm after the second shot. Now, he said he testified to that at the grand jury. And I decided last night to review the differences between his grand jury testimony and the trial testimony. And I noticed something interesting, that the grand jury, he grabbed Sirhan's arm after the second shot. At the trial, after the second shot and maybe the third shot. That's interesting. So it looks like there was some suggestion about adding another shot. The reason for that, of course, is that Robert Kennedy was shot 3 times in his body, and one time the shoulder pad did not touch his body. The gunshot wound number one, you know, the mastoid area, and then the one that, two, was the one that lodged at the sixth cervical vertebra that was under the arm, the axilla, and also under the arm about an inch away. That was a through-and-through bullet. They say that bullet was lost in the interspace. So you see that there were 3 entries into Robert Kennedy's body.
Okay, when you talk about the grid, 13 and 16 on the grid, how far apart are we talking in feet?
Six. That's 6 feet.
About 6 feet?
Yeah, 6 feet different. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I'll tell you something interesting about, which reminds me again about the torn gun label and feet. Criminalist William Harper was very interested because of the distance. He asked me to draw some stick figures and send this to Sirhan about, you know, with your arm outstretched and then bent and on your tiptoes and then squatting down. And I sent him a tape measure so he could provide all of these measurements for criminalist Bill Harper. Also in the letter, I added the question, Sirhan, do you know what happened to the gun box? Now, this is important. Pay attention. And did you remove the gun label? Well, Sirhan answered back, and I have my, because he sent my letter back because of the little stickman he, you know, put in the numbers. And so, no, he does not remember removing the gun label. But in the margin, he asked me, well, perhaps the former owner of the gun would know something about the gun box and the label. So that's interesting, because he knew nothing about it. And so the problem with distance is what Harper had always been working on. And that was, of course, the purpose of providing him with the little stick figure so he could provide the, you know, the measurements, of his, you know, body measurements. And that has, so Sirhan was always in a frontal position. And because this raised a problem, the autopsy report, I have no doubt in my mind that this has to do with the withholding of the autopsy report from the defense. In Harper's files, I came across a memo from Robert Blair Kaiser, who's one of the investigators, who dated February the 22nd, 1969. He writes this memo to Grant Cooper, the chief counsel, about the differences in the autopsy report, you know, that it's the contact wounds. So that was the first that the defense knew had a copy of the autopsy report, because on December the 23rd, Deputy DA John Howard addresses the court that they couldn't turn a copy of the autopsy report over to the defense team because they didn't have a copy. Now, how could that be? The autopsy report was written in June, and Noguchi says that he told the attorney that it was completed the first week of October, and here we are December the 23rd, and there's a withholding of it from the defense. And the problem, of course, as Kaiser pointed out, was the distance, contact wounds, as opposed to feet with Sirhan. There was nobody that put Sirhan
Yes.
Contact position.
Very important. And Larry has some photos for us that have to do with the gunshot wounds. Am I right, Larry?
Yes. Before I show you those, let me show you something that's absolutely new in this case. We have introduced for the first time before the Supreme Court. The gun that the prosecution says...
Can we get a close-up on that, or is it... Okay, tilt it a little toward me.
The gun that the prosecution says is Sirhan's gun is this gun.
Okay.
In the state archives.
Okay.
And you will notice that there is a front sight with a half-moon shape. Now, the only person to describe a gun in Sirhan's possession with any particularity described this gun with a sloping sight as having been seen in Mr. Sirhan's possession at the gun range. That's right. Earlier that day.
Okay.
Not the half moon sight, but the sloping sight. The prosecution withheld a photograph connected with this case that was leaked to a researcher who gave it to us. We know this photograph is connected with this case because it has the Sirhan DR number on it.
Okay.
Notice the shape of the sight. It is a completely different sight, a split level shape. There are three different guns associated with this case. The police suppressed evidence of that fact and only disclosed evidence of a single gun. Why would multiple guns be connected with this case? That indicates multiple shooters. The police apparently took it upon themselves to cover the tracks of multiple shooters and protect them from any kind of prosecution. You ask about the assassination scene. First of all, there were 7 bullets recovered from victims and an 8th bullet lost in the ceiling, according to the police. The Sirhan revolver held 8 bullets. Any crime scene evidence of additional bullets would show multiple shooters. Here we have an FBI photograph depicting circled bullet holes in a pantry doorframe. These are labeled with the initials of a sheriff's department officer. The sheriff's department denies having any files on this case. That's preposterous. The FBI, to this very day, defends the official explanation, even though their own files label these holes as bullet holes.
You know, Larry, this is as confusing as the assassination of JFK.
Well, there was a big cover-up.
Maybe
here.
More.
There was a big cover-up here.
Maybe more. Yeah.
I'll tell you what. The problem of Special Exhibit 10 should not go unmentioned.
Okay, tell us about it.
Oh, boy, that is a shocker. Special Exhibit 10 is a photomicrograph. I was told this story by Dr. Robert Joey. I held the little, it's a 1x1 inch negative.
Is that it?
And I held it,
yes.
He brought it to my home in Nevada. I held it up to the light. And I could see it was a comparison test of 2 bullets. Now, criminalist Duane Wolfer, who's an LAPD officer, he testified in this trial. He said that he compared the Kennedy neck bullet with his test bullet. Now, William Harper had discovered that the envelope that contained the test bullet had another gun number, H18602. But this is what's interesting. So, there is a comparison photograph that would never have seen the light of day, would have been destroyed, but for, I don't know how far I can go in repeating this story, but for a person, he is a hero in this case. He took that negative out of the state and gave it to Dr. Robert Joling to hold on to for safekeeping. Now, I am not authorized to repeat the quote. But he, in fact, told me not to, that I do not have his permission to repeat the quote. But this is a major scandal that a brave person would take this evidence and give it to somebody else. He was now a judge. He was former head of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences to hold on to. And what does that show? The comparison of 2 bullets, the Kennedy neck bullet on the left, that's what it's supposed to be, and Wolfer's test bullet on the right. But mind you, it came from another gun.
Okay, Lynn, hold on a second. Put that up again, Larry. What Explain what Linda's talking about. We're looking at the photo of that right now. Am I right?
That's right.
Okay, now, what does this show?
All right, this is a photograph, a comparison photomicrograph.
The top one.
Created by all three of them, by the LAPD.
Okay.
And ostensibly, this shows a match between the Kennedy neck bullet and a test bullet fired from the Sirhan gun. A panel of experts appointed by the court in 1975 concluded, oh no, this is not a match between those two bullets. It's a match between two victim bullets, the Kennedy neck bullet and the Goldstein bullet. However, we can establish that the Kennedy neck bullet that was used in this photograph was a substitute bullet, and the Goldstein bullet that was used in this photograph was a substitute bullet. We can establish that because the Kennedy neck bullet removed by Dr. Noguchi during the autopsy had TN-31 on its base, but the Kennedy neck bullet examined by the police department and authenticated in 1975 for the court experts had DWTN at the time it was examined. The Goldstein bullet had an X on its base at the time of removal. The so-called Goldstein bullet, the substitute Goldstein bullet, the fake one, had a 6 on its base when that was examined in 1975. So what the police department did is created a completely faked, fraudulent, and fabricated photomicrograph, which actually links together two substitute fraudulent bullets.
Okay.
That's how far they went.
The question is, and I know that, and we're just about coming, are we coming to an end? We're just about there. Quickly, why? Why all the suppression? Why all this nonsense, changing of evidence? Why?
Well, the police department seemed to have acted as though their agenda was to cover the tracks of conspirators and cover up a conspiracy. The question is, for whom would the police department have performed that magnificent service? Would they have done this for a band of Arab political activists who didn't like Robert Kennedy? Of course not. They're not going to do that for them. They would more likely have done this for people in a tremendous position of power, people in government agencies who had a particular agenda that led them to conclude that Robert Kennedy could not be allowed to become president of the United States.
Okay.
And I'm, of course, referring to the Pentagon and the CIA, who wanted to stop Robert Kennedy from becoming president because he was going to stop the war in Vietnam.
Okay, Larry, we're running out of time. Attorney for Sirhan, Larry Teeter. Off stage for security reasons, Adele Sirhan. And on the television, Lynn Mangan, researcher, RFK researcher. Thanks to all three of you. I want to do it again sometime. If you want to make a comment about this show or any show we do, you see it on the screen, 310-281-6744. That's 281-6744. Special thanks to JFK Lancer Productions in Grand Prairie, Texas. Also, Dr. Kirk Murphy in Santa Monica, California, and the Biona Free Press in Westchester, California. And I want to thank Media One for the use of the studios here in Marina Del Rey. And I leave you with music written and performed by Jerry Gallup of Sutter Creek, California. It's called Over the Shoulder, and we'll see you next time.
Had to start somewhere, had to be some beginning. Something that started rings a question in my head.